Thank you all for coming along to this. This is the last of the concurrent sessions from a couple of days. Just want to introduce briefly Estelle Pearson and Andrew Cohen. Estelle and Andy both work for Affinity Consulting, and in their own words, they have more years of GI experience than they care to remember. They have, over the years, provided advice to a number of financial services organisations on their GI strategy. And what this paper is trying to do is to bring together some of the issues and thinkings that they've come across. So I guess without any further ado, I'll hand over. We'll have around about 40 minutes, 35 minutes or so of presentation, and then time for some questions and discussions afterwards. As usual, I'm sure you all know by now, this is all being recorded, so if you have questions or comments to make, please make them up into the microphone. We'll distribute this microphone as we go on to that. Andy.
I did have lunch with a few of you, and I spoke to about four people, and two of them were coming to this presentation. So I extrapolated from that like a good actuary and thought I might need, you know, the room next door. But looks like it's a quiet session. Thank you very much all for coming. I'm going to press a button, hope that this moves on. Perfect. So perhaps a lot of you didn't read the paper. I must confess it went up quite late onto the website. But there is a paper that adds a lot more detail to what I'm going to say. What we're going to talk about is the value chain and how that applies to the general insurance market. Have a look at some of the products that exist in that market to the extent that they may be relevant to a financial services organization. And then from the perspective of a financial services organization, think about what models for operating in this space might be available to you. And then finally move on to a bit more of a structured framework for assessing whether there is an opportunity, and then if there is, sort of how you might put it into practice or what model you might go for. So this isn't a philosophical debate about the meaning of life or anything, but I just was curious as to who might be in the room. We are general insurance actuaries, Estelle and I. I do know a few faces here, funnily enough. But just this will be quite easy, I think, hopefully. Hands up who's in the banking world. About 25% of you, maybe. The wealth management world? Oh, you're in everything. Every world, aren't you, Jennifer? what else have we got?
Reinsurers.
What are you doing here? Superannuation? Anyone from the superannuation world here? Jennifer? Yeah. All right, well, a bit of a mix, and perhaps wondering where you fit into this. Okay. I've got quite a lot to get through. Like I say, talking about the value chain. I got this here. So I like to, I think you guys think about the life cycle of a product, and that applies to a general insurance product also. Quite straightforward, really. The idea is you make that first sale, you acquire the customer. Little bit of administration to get the policy up and running. A claim may or may not happen. Hopefully it doesn't, but they do tend to happen from time to time. So there's a bit of claims management involved. And ultimately, someone makes the payment. And then we come around to renewal again. Hopefully you keep the customer, and on we go. That's the product lifestyle. And I guess, leads us quite neatly to the value chain and an idea of where a financial services organization might play within that life cycle. So we've broken the value chain up into, I guess, those elements. At the sales end of the process, is there a space for a financial services organization? Perhaps a bit of policy administration that the organization might get involved with. And those are typically not taking on too much in the way of insurance risks. Risks are, that is what I would call the distribution side of the business. And then moving on to the claim side, really where most of the insurance risk is, the administration of the claim and the payment of the claim itself is more to do with the manufacturing side of the business. And very quickly, and we'll go into in a bit more detail later on, just what the remuneration looks like on the distribution side. It's more in the form of commission, a fee for a service, whatever that service might be. And then on the manufacturing side, there's obviously the rest of the profit margin. There's a what we're calling the manufacturing margin. Now, across the whole value chain, typically the target return on capital is 15 to 25% of capital allocated. That's before tax. That is a target. It's an average over the insurance cycle. We have a fair few ups and downs in the general insurance business, and that is a feature of the business. I think some people thought the cycle was dead when HIH disappeared from the landscape, but that wasn't to be, and I'm not surprised personally that that wasn't to be. So there is a cycle which you have to manage across. So that headline rate there is a targeted average. That a lot of insurance companies might operate in that range across a whole insurance cycle, which can last a number of years. Okay, so obviously there's value in the chain, hence the word, the phrase value chain. And where are those building blocks of value? I guess the more space you occupy in that value chain, the more value you're going to capture. We'll go into this a little bit more detail later on, but at a simple model for a financial services organization might be just, you know, some contact with their customers and just passing a referral through to an external insurance entity. So just a little bit of referral of a lead, and then they're not interested in the process whatsoever, might capture a little bit of value, a little bit of the margin just for surfacing that lead. Obviously, the more you get involved in the sale of the product, the more perhaps you're doing the job for the manufacturer, and the more you might get some value in that value chain. And finally, if you're selling the product and taking on some risk as well, then you're capturing potentially the full value, that full 15 to 25% ROC. So those are what I've called the building blocks of value. With value comes a bit of risk. So obviously the more value reward you seek to get, not surprisingly, the more risk you take on at each step of the process. So my thinking is, even when you're referring leads, there's some association in your customer's eyes with the product or the insurer that you're referring to. So perhaps there's a little bit of reputation or brand risk that you have there. Moving on to getting more involved with the state of the product, you might not be taking on the risk, but you might be doing a little bit of a bit more selling. Then you're getting more identified with that product, so there is a bit more reputation and brand risk, and of course you're investing a bit more of your own operations in selling that product, so there's a little bit of expense risk. And then sort of finally, once you get to taking on the claims risk, that probably swamps the other risks I talked about at the end of the day. That really is taking a lot more risk in order to get that extra value. Okay. So it's quite broadly here, what's in it for a financial services organization. As we talked about, on the upside, you're capturing more value. You're getting a stream of profits that's different to the existing stream of profits that you have, so there's some diversification benefit there. And I think importantly, you know, one of the assets that a lot of people in the banking and wealth management space have is their customer base, and you're extracting hopefully maximum value from that customer base, the cross-sell opportunity, shall we say. Of course, in order to get those pluses, there are some minuses. If you're trying to get that extra value, you're taking on extra risk, and that needs some allocation of capital. While there is some profit diversification, there is a bit more volatility in profits with a general insurance product than may typically be the case for other wealth management and banking products. And historically, at least, the returns on capital from the general insurance business over a long period of time have been quite low, or relatively low, compared to what the banks have achieved. Having said that, and ignoring the last 12 months, that the last 5 years have actually, the general insurance industry has outperformed the banking industry, I must add, and have numbers for the broader wealth management industry, but the GI industry has done very well in the last 5 years, and there's a number of reasons for that, which I'll talk about when I give an overview of the market. Very, very broadly, I guess if the pluses are greater than the minuses, you might want to sort of take a position in the value chain that's quite quite broad, and manufacture. If the minuses are more than the pluses, you might want to step back away from taking on the extra risk and distribute or even don't bother. That's a very broad summary. It's a bit more complicated, I think, the process for coming up with that decision, and I'll talk about the many issues that also come to bear in deciding where to play in the value chain. Okay. So that's a little bit of talk about the value chain. Moving on, just looking at the general insurance market, and in particular what products might be relevant to a financial services company. There's quite a range of business lines that are sold in the market. I won't go into them in great detail. There's a bit more detail about them in the paper, including some mapping, shall we say, of the features of those products and how they might be relevant to a financial services organization. But you can see personal lines, home and motor make up a fair proportion of the business. So those are people like you and me who have a house or a car and want to insure them. CTP is a compulsory class, compulsory third party, so that has to be purchased, so there's a ready-made market there. And then there's commercial lines, which are split into commercial liability, that's public liability, professional indemnity, directors and officers, those sort of types of coverage. And fire and ISR is companies protecting their property assets, so that's fire and flood and earthquake and all sorts of things that I think are thrown into a commercial property policy, including business interruption cover as well, so loss of profits following an event. So the market is $25 billion in total premium once a year, excluding reinsurance, a little bit more with the reinsurance, and that's about 2.5% of GDP. We think that's big enough to play in, don't we, Estelle? But I know it's not the $1 trillion of superannuation assets that I guess you guys have been talking about for the last day and a half, but there's plenty of premium there. Okay. So as I said, there's quite a wide product range. It's always evolving. It's trying to meet emerging risks and trying to meet the needs of the customers that are out there. The way the products are distributed is of relevance. Much of the personal lines in particular, but not just personal lines, is distributed really in a direct relationship without the use of a broker or an agent in between, whereas the commercial lines tend to be more distributed through a broker. And the insured, by doing that, is not just getting a policy sold. They also feel like they're getting some advice on what sorts of cover they need and the nature of cover. The amounts of cover that are relevant to their business. So there's an advice element in that, which may be a bit difficult to replicate in your businesses if you want to play in that space. In the commercial line space, there is a small business element, which tends to buy more of a plain vanilla product, and it's therefore more easily sold to, shall we say, and less of an advice element. APRA are the regulator. And the regulatory landscape has changed a hell of a lot in the last 6 or 7 years since HIH went bust. It continues to evolve in the general insurance space, although I feel like it's leveling off now, which is good. But you know, regulation is a heavy burden, and that's something to think about, especially when you're moving from distribution into manufacturing. There are, in fact, 130 general insurance licenses out there, so companies licensed to do business. Some of those will be just in runoff. Others will be part of a major group. In general, out of those 130, I think you could say the top 4 or 5 account for 80% of the premium volume, so it's a pretty concentrated market, and there's 126 medium-sized and small companies out there, shall we say. And that makes for some interesting dynamics in the market in terms of competition. I said top 4 or 5, maybe it'll be the top 3 or 4 in a few months' time, but with IAG and QBE. Although I guess if you guys have been locked up in a conference, you might not have read the press, which is going a bit lukewarm on it today. Might be different tomorrow. So that's it. In a broad sense, it is the landscape. I might talk a little bit about HIH. You know, in the HIH days, anyone here from HIH? Anyone to put their hand up? Own up? Good. I'm being recorded, aren't I? So. In the HIH days, it's particularly in the liability space, those sort of long tail lines of business where it is quite hard to assess the risk in an actuarial sense. HIH were, shall we say, quite competitive in that market, and a lot of the competition, a lot of their competition in order to be in that market had to really follow their prices to some extent. That's simplifying things a bit. But when HIH disappeared from the landscape, prices went up quite significantly, particularly in the liability line of business. And on top of that, we had some major reforms, some major tort reform, which improved the landscape as well. Few mergers and consolidations have taken place since then as well, so the market's got more concentrated, so arguably competition is a bit more rational, perhaps. So that's coincided with a period of quite low cost weather event, or the weather event cost has been lower than the average. The last 12 months has been different, but we had many years with pretty good weather costs, and at the same time the economy has been pretty good. So kind of a lot of factors led to a pretty robust insurance market, and 2006 saw some pretty good returns on capital, 20% plus on average, and doing you know some pretty good profits coming out. The last 12 months, so you can see that the industry is a little bit under pressure, mainly because of storm events, but some other factors as well. So it's a moving feast, the GI market, but certainly a bit more of a stable environment compared to the pre 2001 days. So how's the GI market relevant to a financial services company? I think the first thing actually to think about is the financial services business itself. You know, what is the customer base that exists already? Is it large or small? If it's large, then there's obviously some relatively low penetration rates might still give you a reasonable market share. If it's small, is the opportunity really there for you? Is it broad-based or niche? And importantly, I guess, what do your customers look like? Are they high-net-worth individuals all driving Ferraris, in which case you might want to get into some motor insurance space, or might not? Or is it, much more broad-based? I guess there's a lot of things to think about in terms of, what your customers look like, and therefore what sort of products might be relevant to them. What products do you offer? Well, I'm calling you. I know you're not all in the wealth management space, but what products are? Is it loans? Is it foreign exchange transactions? Are they superannuation? Think about those products, and I guess, is there a natural contact with the customer through which you can, while making the sale or the contact on your own product, start suggesting the other product? I guess that moves on to your distribution method and how strong is your relationship with the customer. Do you have a direct relationship with the customer, in which case perhaps you are in a position to offer something that makes sense to them? I guess if you're still distributing yourself through other parties, you're a bit removed, and you might not be able to on-sell general insurance products. Is your brand well known and trusted? I guess is important. Are people going to trust you if you offer another product that they're not used to hearing from you? And as I mentioned, I guess is there a good point of sale, say with a loan, and packaging that with household insurance, a good point of sale for your own product where you can sell a general insurance product? So I think that's a starting point to consider whether you actually have an entry point into the market. And then next, one might start considering what sort of products make sense to a financial services business. I've listed them in alphabetical order at this stage because we'll go through a few slides as to what might make more sense. And my comments here are quite broad. I think every entity has its own characteristics to think about. But quickly, commercial lines business, if you've got contact with commercial customers, commercial businesses, then there's a potential there. consumer credit makes sense. It's loan related. I guess a lot of that sort of straddles the life and general insurance industry. Home business, as I mentioned, that can get packaged up with a mortgage. Lender's mortgage, obviously, and some banks already play in that space. Motor business, there's obviously an opportunity there with motor loans. And I guess just the broad customer base gives you a fair bit of leeway perhaps to market all of these if you have a broad customer base. Personal accident makes sense. Travel that will also make sense as a potential candidate. So as I said, which ones might you choose? Well, think about your own business first and who your customers are and what products you're selling. And then we get on to what are the characteristics of each of those products and how might you operate, how might you be involved with those products. So there's quite a lot of characteristics. Preliminary research perhaps is the way to think about it. In each of those products, what are the key characteristics? How do they fit with your own strategy, with your customer base, and I guess with your general business, is there a good fit? So I won't go through all of those, but what they mean. But how big's the market? What's the claims profile? Are you exposed to catastrophes, and that leads to volatility, or perhaps there's some operational needs to deal with them? Short tail or long tail, although compared to life insurance and superannuation, I think you'd define all these as short tail. Is there a cycle that impacts volatility? And of course, then we start getting into numbers. How profitable have they been in the past? The distribution mechanism typically for these products, is that does that give you a route into the market? Do you have a natural point of sale? How difficult is it to price? And beyond pricing, is there any individual underwriting that might be needed, which might require special expertise? So there's a range of things, a bit of background in order, if you're starting to assess the opportunity, what products you might want to get involved with. There's a range of characteristics you might want to get into. So I've done a couple of graphs here, trying to map each of those products and think about how easy are they to distribute only, and how easy are they to, and what sort of level of administration might be involved. Starts leading you perhaps towards a ranking of how easy or difficult it is to get into a particular product. So these are our thoughts. I'm happy to have a discussion afterwards, but thought consumer credit might be relatively easy, and leading all the way up to commercial might be relatively difficult to distribute and can be quite difficult to administer. So that's administration relative to distribution. And then moving on from distribution, how easy is it to manufacture? Again, we have a similar ranking. Consumer credit, we think, is sort of down towards the low end of ease of manufacture. Commercial up at the high end, motor reasonably high, higher than home. And then that little group of PA, lenders, mortgage and travel, sort of moderate to easy. So that led us to a ranking of the products I put up before. Just generally sort of consumer credit might be the easiest for a financial services business to get into. PA, Travelers, Lenders, Mortgage, reasonably similar in terms of difficulty of getting into. Then home, then motor. And commercial lines were probably only on a limited basis. There's quite a wide range of classes of business in that commercial lines bucket. And we probably thought that if to play in that space, you'd be focused on the small and medium enterprise element of it rather than the high-end big business stuff. Okay. So I sort of thought of that as perhaps your preliminary research. You've got some ideas of whether there might be a possibility of playing in the GI space. And then let's look at sort of what models might be available. So I guess you might have concluded don't bother, which may well be a valid conclusion to make depending on the characteristics of your own business. But you might feel perhaps there's some potential. You've got a customer base and natural points of contact with that customer, whereby you want to get into some type of distribution role. Now or sometime in the future, you might think there are some potential to get into manufacturing of those products. So some examples of that, I guess, where you might say, don't bother, and I'm happy for someone to say, no, you're wrong. But I thought if you're, a fund manager trying to sell lenders mortgage insurance, might not be a good fit. CTP business, you might find that quite hard to manufacture, but maybe not be able to distribute it. And perhaps if you're a bank and in the home, distributing home, and there's a few of them out there, then you might manufacture as well as distribute as well. So those are some ideas of sort of how the combination of model and product might come together. We'll investigate that in a bit more detail. I guess each of those model features, the distribution, manufacture, I've taken out don't bother. I don't think it has any features. But they have certain characteristics. I guess in terms of what the product is are important to know. We've talked about that. Different ways of remunerating or rewarding the risks that you're taking. Different levels of risk between distribution and manufacturing. Of course, with taking on risk, there's different capital needs they need to be thought about. The regulatory implications are greater for a manufacturer. Interesting one is the control of the product and the customer. So when you get into distribution, I guess in some sense you're sharing your relationship with the customer with a manufacturer. If you're doing manufacturing and distribution, you've got control of that whole process. And finally, and quite importantly, is operational needs. So, what do you need internally to be able to manage as a distributor only versus what would you need in terms of operational capability to be a manufacturer? So it's a relatively simple game if you're a distributor. You have some expenses embedded in your distribution network, some IT and some management overhead, probably a few other things as well, and you're getting remunerated by a third party, by a manufacturer, according to how much business you might generate for them. There may be a profit-related element in that as well, so it might be there's an incentive for you to generate profitable business rather than just any business, and the mix between those can be quite interesting. But basically, the distributor is trying to manage its expense base to optimize its revenue and, I guess, maximize the margin between the two. It's quite straightforward to some extent. Once you start building manufacturing on, there's quite a lot more to think about on the revenue side and on the expenses side. Obviously, you're getting the whole premium now. You're earning a bit of investment income on it. And if you have a bit of reinsurance or some third-party recoveries, you're getting some revenue in from that. But against that, you've got the claims payments, the gross claims payments, and probably some reinsurance premium to pay also. And then all your expenses as well. And I haven't listed all the expenses that are there, but I have added regulation and compliance as being a more significant expense in this model than if you're just distributing. So that's the model you're operating there to generate your profit. Now, just going back to if you're operating the distribution space, we talked about the remuneration being a commission rate, on the volumes of business, and also to some extent the profitability of it. How much commission might you get? That's a very interesting question. I don't really have any answers or any benchmarks to give you. I think every arrangement is quite different. It is subject to intense negotiation between the general insurer and the financial services business. But in a broad sense, I guess the more of their job you do in sort of acquiring the business or administering any of the business, the more of the commission you might expect to get. You know, you're sort of paying some of their expense base and taking it on board yourself by getting highly involved in the sales process. But at the other end, if you're just passing leads through, you're not really doing very much for them apart from well, that's not fair to say. You're doing quite a lot for them. You're getting a new distribution channel for them, but you're generating the customer, but a lot of the pricing and underwriting and administering is being done still with the general insurer, so there might be less commission on offer there. Okay, so looking at, I had a slide up before that looked at the various dimensions you might look at manufacturing and distribution, and I've put in some, I guess, some broadening of the distribution model and some broadening of the manufacturing model. Two distribution models I've put in there. One is the referrals only, where you're not doing very much. One where the wealth manager, the financial services organization, is more involved in the sales and the policy admin. And then there's three manufacturing models that I've put there. One is where you're entered into a JV with someone who has some of the expertise that you may not already have. Outsourcing is similar to that, but there's no capitals sort of sharing of the risk on the capital base. You're just outsourcing a key function, like perhaps the claims management. And then there's the standalone business where you've got all your operation capabilities covered internally, and you've put all the capital in yourself. So I guess in terms of capital needs, our thinking was, if you're in the distribution space, it's pretty small. You might need a bit of working capital to keep you going for the next 3 months, shall we say, that sort of float of money. That's about it. As soon as you start jumping into manufacturing, a bit of a quantum leap in the capital that you need, because you're taking on a lot more risk, particularly the insurance risk. In the joint venture entity, you're sharing that risk with another entity, so the needs aren't so much, but by the time you're just outsourcing some operations but keeping all the risk to yourself, a lot more capital is needed. So where in that space that you might operate might depend, amongst other things, on your appetite for risk, how much capital you've got, and whether the capital you've got can be better deployed elsewhere perhaps. Okay, the regulatory burden pretty much looks the same. Not much regulatory burden, I don't think, involved in just being a distributor. A bit of AFSL stuff and a bit of sales training needed, and some of the regulations around that. But as soon as you step up to being a manufacturer, you're well in the land of APRA and all the ongoing regulation that's required there. And typically, to be a manufacturer, you need to be a separate corporate entity, so there's other regulatory and compliance requirements as a result. What sort of infrastructure might you need? So as a distributor, you need some infrastructure, some way of communicating with the manufacturer, what policies you've, what customers you've surfaced, or what policies you've perhaps put on the books for them. But the infrastructure needs obviously increase as you get into manufacturing, particularly around claims management, where you start. If you're taking on that risk, you may want to you'll need to build some claims management capability. Although if you're out, you can outsource it or get into a JV where that capability is provided. So it is a bit of a cascading line there, until ultimately, when you're full manufacturer, you want the capability in house. So I guess on that line, where might you operate? Depends what you have already, whether you have an appetite to build that capability. And scale of the business, the current scale of the business might dictate where you are. And I've got a slide later that really shows you might actually move up that line as the scale of your business increases, as you get some critical mass and it makes more sense to have the capabilities in-house. And there we are. So I think as scale increases, you can move up towards manufacturing if it makes sense. There's many other issues as well, but if it makes sense, a bit of scale makes it easier to be a manufacturer and to be in control of the whole process. And it's worth noting that those three or four companies that dominate the general insurance market are obviously quite large, so they have some scale advantages over smaller players, and that needs to be managed carefully if you're building scale. Although IAG, I think, have noted that they're rationalising expenses, and I think their expense rates still have been creeping up quite a bit in the last few years. Okay, so distribution versus manufacturing. How much profit is there in it? So in a dollar sense, the distribution profit, I think, is an order of magnitude smaller than the potential profit that's there in the manufacturing margin as well. At the same time, though, there's more volatility in the combined distribution manufacturing profit from year to year than there might be in the distribution margin on its own. So that's something. So that's sort of an average position, but around that average, there's a fair bit more volatility if you're a manufacturer. So in dollar terms, there's a lot more value on offer if you get into manufacturing. Percentages can be deceptive, I guess, unless you. But perhaps they are worth focusing on. In percentage terms, because the distribution model doesn't require much capital, the returns on capital that you can get look very high and could be perhaps twice as high as the return on capital that you might get from getting into manufacturing as well. So there's that sort of interesting dynamic there. More dollars on offer if you're in manufacturing, obviously. But percentage returns on capital, you're quite likely to exceed your hurdle rates, or more likely to exceed your hurdle rates if you're a distributor only. Okay, so that's a bit of background, a lot of background on distribution and manufacturing. I guess a company has a strategic focus and a strategic process to go through. And a lot of what I've said so far will feed into that process. And this next section really looks at, how you take that process a bit further and test each proposition and what might make most sense to an organization. So coming back to that, I think it's a product-by-product consideration that needs to be done because each product is different and has different opportunities. Some are easier to some are easier to manufacture than others, as we saw. So obviously there's the conclusion that you don't bother and perhaps you don't proceed any further with this part of the process. But otherwise, do we distribute, do we manufacture? What else should we look at to make those decisions? So there's a range of issues which I perhaps have alluded to in so far already. Hey, can you guys hear me all right, by the way? Suddenly got louder. So across those headings, operational issues to consider, financial issues to consider, organizational issues to consider. Financial issues, obviously, very important, but the other two issues are also, I think, very important as well. So it doesn't just come down to numbers, unfortunately for us actuaries. So just running through that list, whether I've talked about all of those. I think I probably have. In one way or another. So those are the headings you might consider, you need to consider as part of the decision. Getting more into the detail, again, on a product-by-product basis, I guess these are quite obvious in terms of looking at the market itself. How big is it? What are its growth prospects? What's the competition doing? What's their strategy? Is there space for you? The second point is something I don't think I've really mentioned too much, but very important. I guess it's in two parts. Is there a space for you? And how well can you leverage that space? And you may, I guess, have a great customer base, but you may be in an organization which has many products that are competing for attention. So can the sales force be incentivized to generate the volumes that you want or you need? So that's very important. Important before you enter into the opportunity, and obviously very important once you go live. And other things to think about, apart from size and growth prospects, is kind of focused on the premium side of things. There's obviously the profitability side of things as well. So what's the claims experience been? How variable has it been as well? It's one thing to look at averages, but as I mentioned, general insurance businesses can be quite variable. So it's good to know that, and particularly sort of what's the catastrophe exposure that can lead to a fair bit of variability. Even if you're buying reinsurance, that can mitigate some of that variability. You'll still be left with a fair bit on your balance sheet if there's a high frequency of catastrophe losses. So that's some metrics to think about in terms of the market for your particular product. then the process really is to get, I guess, down and dirty with some of the financials that one typically looks at in general insurance. Where does the profit come from? What return on capital does it generate? So on the left-hand side, there's the financials of, you know, the ins and outs, shall we say, of premium and claims. Gives you a loss ratio. You've got expenses going out. The loss ratio and the expense ratio combined gives you what we call a combined operating ratio. Ideally, you want that to be less than 100%, which means what's coming in is more than what's going out. There's a bit of investment income in there as well, which is important, but I haven't really referred to it. But that is part of the equation. But anyway, on each product, if you've got 1%, if your outgoings are 1% less than your premium coming in, you have a 1% profit margin. On the capital side, depending on the product, again, will depend on how much capital you need for it. So typically, short tail products require less capital than long tail products. So property related business is less volatile than liability related business, and the property business therefore requires less capital. The APRA framework is quite important here. It sets a minimum against which you need to hold capital. Typically, you need to hold more capital than the minimum, and that buffer above minimum is typically more than is required for a life insurance business. And it varies from company to company, depends on a number of things, for example, access to capital elsewhere, and I guess sort of the overall attitude towards managing the capital base of the whole organization. But essentially, they're taking the two sides together. There's a profit margin, there's a capital requirement. The two together can give you a return on capital. Now, that's looking at the product as a whole. It's important then to try and break that down into its distribution and manufacturing components. And then you really start getting a feel for, you know, whether it's worth getting into manufacturing to capture that extra margin. What are the dollars available from the extra margin? And you can place that against the background of what's the extra risk you're taking on. Now, your decision on whether to move, this is a graph looking at how much value you might get operating as a distributor or as a manufacturer and distributor combined. So as a distributor, it's a bit stylized because the profit commission might change things a little bit for a distributor, but generally, if you're managing your expense base well, you've kind of got a fairly flat level of value that you're getting out of your participation in the market. No matter what the profitability of the business, again, ignoring the profit commission element, no matter what the profitability of the business, you hopefully sort of keeping your volumes up, managing your expense base and getting a level of commission. But if you're into manufacturing, the value you're creating, the profit you're making, obviously depends on your combined operating ratio, i.e. your profit margin. So at some point, the combined operating ratio is such that you're going to be making more money than as a distributor, and that point's quite important. If that point is considered achievable, judging by historical experience in the line of business or your own particular way you're going to manage the business or the type of customers you think you might get, if you think you're going to get reasonably low combined operating ratios or lower than that break-even point, then it's you can start thinking about being in manufacturing. I guess there's a lot to do in terms of financials that can be modelled. If you're getting quite serious about it, you've gone through that whole process I've talked about, done a few numbers and got to the point where, yeah, maybe it does have some legs, then there's quite a few things that can be done to prove the point. Obviously, there's preparing the business case, so developing some full financial models, profit and loss accounts and balance sheets, working out returns on capital. And it's important to do this over quite a few years because you may be building that business and the profitability of that business will change as the business gets bigger and achieves critical mass. Talking a bit of life insurance talk, there's the potential to work out some appraisal values. What's the value of the business that you might be creating? So I guess allowing for that future business that you're capturing, retention rates for general insurance customers can be, depends on product, but can be 80-90%. So you build up a, you know, after a few years, your book shifts from being a book that relies on capturing new customers all the time to one that's got a, you know, a fairly good momentum in terms of renewals coming through. And that adds to, I guess, to that appraisal value. And then we're still thinking about whether to be in distribution or manufacturing. I guess you start sort of tinkering around with those models to see just whether, you know, doing separate models for each of distribution and each of the forms of manufacturing models that might be out there. And I guess, and look at, I guess, the returns on capitals that are achieved, and the appraisal values and the values of the business that are coming out. Okay, coming to the end, hence the summary. So hopefully I've given a flavour of the fact that there is some value to be captured in the general insurance value chain, but there are ups and downs to be considered. The value that's there will depend on not only the characteristics of the GI products that make sense to you, but also on, I guess, your existing financial services business. It's possible to rank the GI products and consider opportunities as they, you know, on the basis of that ranking. There's a range of models that can be considered depending on how you want to play in that space. A lot of issues, quantitative and qualitative, to be considered. And what I haven't shown on there, which I should have done, is, I guess, coming back to that incentivization of the sales and distribution network, whether that is feasible in your organization. So that's really about it. Hopefully, you know, given a flavour of that, there's an opportunity out there to recognise, I guess, the full value of the customer base. Are there distribution opportunities that with that customer base that you have? It's a valuable asset. Are there distribution opportunities that you can build on? And I guess moving away from distribution, does manufacturing make sense? If not now, perhaps as you build some scale in through the distribution side of things, is there potential later on to get into manufacturing? So, I mean, there is more value on offer, as I've shown, but there are other risks to think about as well. That's about it, Craig. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew, for an interesting talk there. I think we just throw it straight open to questions. So, comments, questions, just use this mic here if anyone wants to kick off.
I think when you look at the Kent Hopper, by the way, you look at the profitability, and you had some numbers for a couple of product lines in one of those slides there. It's not something that really makes me overly excited when I see those sorts of numbers. It's probably reasonably borderline, but just as an observation, I saw some stuff recently, and I'm having a seniors moment. I can't remember where it was, but it was saying that. It's coming out of the US, I think, and was saying that banks that also have an insurance operation within the group are reporting profitability of something like 15% greater than those that don't. Now, there could be a myriad of reasons for that, I suppose, as well, other than just that, but it suggests at least that there's a strengthening of the customer relationship there, and you're getting a bit greater share of wallet and so forth. So to my mind, that's probably where the value of not just general insurance but the whole wealth management sphere can really add more value. One of the slides you had there talked about scale and how that might affect what decision you make in entering into a GI product line. What I'd like to ask you is, can we put some numbers around that? What's a sort of a reasonable scale for some of the key product lines that you had four or five of them up there? What's a reasonable scale that a company should be shooting for? Then you think, okay, we've reached something that's sustainable.
So I think, first of all, I did see that. Some reference to that banking survey coming out of the US, and you're right, customer loyalty, customer retention, maybe improve, you know, those customers you're selling to are your better customers. I did see that. It's actually, I think, headed up. It had a headline to do with CommonShore, funnily enough. So, or the one, the reference I saw did. Going back to your question here, I think of a small but viable portfolio, I guess I'm thinking personal lines here, as being of the order of $50 million, as small but viable, but still... 50. But still small compared to, you know, the much bigger portfolios that are run by the IAGs of this world. I think once you start getting into, you know, up to $500 million, you're getting a pretty reasonable size portfolio which can stand alone in terms of, you know, running its own operations. And obviously there's still more, you know, once you go from $500 to a $2 billion portfolio, you know, there's more leverage off your expense base and economies of scale there as well. So typically the expense base we see is falling reasonably sharply from being, you know, a 5 million portfolio coming going to 50 million as a bit of a sharp fall. And then there's a continuing gradual fall in the expense rate as you go from, say, 50 million up to 500 million or so. I mean, in the motor market, 500 million is about a 10% market share.
I don't think, I mean, I think a lot of the profit figures for general insurance products don't look particularly interesting for banks. And I guess when you look at the products that banks are most likely to be in from a manufacturing sense, they are the ones with a particularly low combined operating ratio. So things like consumer credit, where you might be running at a 50 or 60% combined operating ratio. Householders is much more profitable than motor. So I think as well, if you look at what products... the banks actually do manufacture as opposed to distribute, you tend to find that they're the more profitable ones. The other thing that I wonder with banks is, I guess the other thing to think about as a financial service organisation is just the cost of sale as well, because there are some situations where you've already done the work with a customer to get them over the line in purchasing a particular banking product, so the cost of selling a general insurance product is actually quite low. Which could be different to how you choose to remunerate people for making that sale, but the actual cost of doing it can be pretty low.
So that was something to add on that as well. I guess the numbers up there are industry averages, and you know, a bank or a wealth manager might have a particular type of customer that perhaps is different to the industry average. So let's, for example, a customer taking out a mortgage and a home insurance product at the same time might be a different level of risk to your broad-based book that's run by IAG or AMI. So in that whole process that you might go through in your strategic thinking, that's something to think about.
Victor Bajanov, I wonder, do you think there's a significant effect of the of moving into the insurance market having a reverse effect on the original products, the original financial services products that are being offered? So, for example, a bank offering credit products that moves into consumer credit insurance might find that the default risk profile of the customers changes as a result of that. Is there any comment or advice that you can give in that?
I don't know. I think, so you think it's by virtue of a customer having a consumer credit product, they feel like they can default and it's all covered.
Well, so. Or that the combination of the two, as is being marketed, might attract a different type of customer to what they used to get on their credit cards or their home loans.
Yeah, look, I don't know what the answer to that is, really. I haven't thought about that. I mean, I think consumer credit, as I understand it, is sold, you know, as an add-on, I guess, in the pricing of it, you know, one takes account of the selection effects, whether your customer base is the customer base that's going to default more than your typical customer base. I guess that's part of the dynamic in those who take out the product are those most likely to claim, but it should be embedded in your pricing.
Yeah, so you think it should be embedded in the pricing of the
insurance product? Yeah.
Okay, so you don't think there's any effect on the original credit products that it has, like the transfer of risk maybe being from defaulting the credit to the insurance arm? Or?
I must say I haven't thought about the other side of the equation, shall we say. I don't know whether anyone in the banking world here has gone down that path and thought about that. I mean, I think, you know, the deepening of the customer relationship tends to be a positive rather than a negative is what Kent was saying just then, and something I do talk about in my papers. I think it probably works more the other way, off the top of my head.
I wasn't necessarily trying to imply that there would be a negative effect, but, for example, you might need to hold less capital on your banking products as a result of having transferred that risk to consumer credit insurance, which is maybe your own operation as well. But
if there's a sort of an arbitrage play there on the capital that's needed, I think some of those loopholes have been closed down and things are converging. Certainly in the lender's mortgage, things have changed a bit in that world.
But just on that, I had some time at Colonial State Bank prior to the Commonwealth Bank merger taking.
That's where you are now, is it?
Right. Sorry?
I was wondering where you were, Ross.
Nah. The Allstate Bank of New South Wales had an insurance licence by virtue of being a government-owned, state government-owned. It used to write credit insurance, and they did it on virtually no-expense basis. It was just a tick in the box on the loan record, but it was back in the days when you could insist on it. It was compulsory. Thou shalt have insurance. Very fat premium rates. People didn't even know they had it in a lot of cases. Mm. It was might have been loss ratio 5%. It was money for old rope.
It was like one for consumer credit.
It was. That was certainly a very easy product.
Yeah.
And I think the same with the mortgage side of it there. That was compulsory to have insurance, although they didn't write home insurance at that time. But they insisted on having insurance. I guess perhaps these days CommInsure might, they can't insist on their own product, but encourage the insurance sense. You know, it's a good relationship. Mm.
I was just going to ask an capital arbitrage question, possibly. We had a presentation this morning from people talking about the impact of Basel II on the mortgage market, but peripherally talked about LMI and how it was much less attractive these days for a bank to have LMI. It was always almost more attractive to insource. I wondered if you could talk about that a bit.
Yes, you're right. So there was previously a huge capital arbitrage under Basel I in the capital saving that banks got compared with the capital that the LMI company had to hold. But basically that's kind of disappeared. And the calculations I've done on it is that there's no capital arbitrage. And that, in fact, potentially for some loans, there's actually potentially a little bit more capital in total once you buy LMI insurance. So there's definitely a greater incentive to self-insure. I think the market will change. I mean, I think there'll be some sort of big changes in the market. And different markets have gone different ways, as you'll know. In New Zealand's, I know, in some markets, people charge. I guess one of the things with LMI is it's a way to charge a little bit more for risk, whereas under a normal banking mortgage, you just have a set rate, no matter what the risk of the customer, whereas it's a way to charge a bit more. So maybe you start charging a slightly differential sort of margin for risk.
Yep, we've got time for one last question.
Lawrence Heyman. I was wondering, there are different banks have gone down different models. Is there any evidence that being a manufacturer actually improves the level of cross-sell, which for a lot of banks is a fairly key measure?
I thought having more products to offer, it gives you that chance to cross-sell, and there are banks out there with some pretty good portfolios of personal lines business.
I guess, say, two banks, one distributes someone else's product for home insurance.
Right, with you,
Is there any noticeable difference there?
So my gut feel is that over time there would be. The fact that you're selling your own product rather than passing it through to someone else if the incentivization of the sales force is done right, should improve cross-sell. There's, I think, a lot of upside from moving to manufacturing if you can incentivize your sales force. A lot of other issues to think about, as I've spoken about, but the cross-sell ratio should, you'd think, would improve.
Okay, I think we're out of time now, so all that's left to do is to join me in thanking Andrew and Estelle for the paper and the session today in the usual way, so thank you.